The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only. All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of Life of Flow. Today we have Dr. Jim Coleman. Dr. Jim Coleman is a vascular surgeon, native of Ireland, and he is the CEO of Vasorum. He has a super interesting story, pioneering entrepreneurship, device development, especially in the access closure space. And today he's going to give us his story about how he came up through his medical training, how he got interested in devices, and how he's had, you know, success developing a closure device that some of us use.
Yeah, so, pretty cool story.
Yeah, it's a great story.
Yeah.
So enjoy.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
Are you avoiding showing your legs because of varicose veins? Worry no more. At Hope Vascular and Podiatry, we have the solution. Our vascular specialists are ready to rid you of those pesky varicose veins. Regain your confidence and enjoy life without complexes. Call 346-400-4673 or visit our website at www.hcic.io. Because at Hope Vascular and Podiatry, the new normal is you better.
Jim, it's such a pleasure to have you here. I always say that we talk about everything vascular and not in this podcast. And the fact that you embody both, not that they're not related, but it's, you know, you are a vascular surgeon and you also have this entrepreneur side of you, you know, this scientist side of you, this probably engineering side of you. And so it's going to be great to hear how you maneuvered this in order to get to where you're at here. And so we're here to really discuss about this particular project of yours related to vascular access closure. But it'd be great to hear a little bit about the man behind the plan and how you got to migrate from Ireland to the U.S. and then possibly migrate your migration from clinical to investigational to entrepreneurship. And maybe a little bit of a summary of how, what path, what led you to come to the U.S.? How'd you get to that point? What was the inflection in the career?
Great, Miguel. Well, thank you very much to yourself and Lucas for the opportunity to contribute to your great podcast. I'm quite honored. I suppose I should go back to my younger days. I was a medical student in the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. And, you know, in Ireland, we don't do necessarily an undergraduate degree. You can go that route. But so I was a young guy, 18, going into medical school, wasn't sure whether engineering or medicine was for me initially. But, you know, I really came down on the side of medicine because science is one of my top loves, basically. And got into medical school and had a great time, actually. And everything was new, of course, for me as a budding doctor. Met my wife, who's German. Every summer I'd work abroad, and we had our first child when I was a medical student. She was a geology student, and finished up at about 23, and was started my internship. And in Ireland, your internship, much like the US, I guess, is 6 months medicine, 6 months surgery. And it was that 6 month surgery which really got me onto the surgical bug and the surgical rotation and everything surgical. And I was very fortunate to be taken under the wing of my chief, Professor David Boucher Hayes, who was professor of surgery in the College of Surgeons. It was really through his guidance, really, that I took on my residency with a specialization in vascular surgery. My other professor, Professor Paddy Collins, he was my general surgery professor, and he advised when I was going for the rotation that, you know, doc, if you want to do surgery, you should put your balls on ice. But of course, you know, at that time he didn't know I had a child already, and it was great fun to go in with a young family into the rotation with great support from my wife. So that really is my background. took me through all my training up to the time that Professor Belcher Hayes, who was very well connected in the United States, he arranged for my fellowship with Dr. Alan Callow in Tufts University New England Medical Center. So that's how I kind of gravitated from the residency into the specialization of research in vascular surgery and ultimately further vascular surgery down the road from there.
And when you were finishing your training in Ireland and you were thinking of, you know, what do I do next? Why did you decide, instead of just going into practice, to do this fellowship? Did you have an idea that you wanted to develop devices per se, or was this research going in another direction and then went to devices? How did that work out?
Yeah, so when you finish your residency in Ireland, we undertake kind of a higher, let's say, research fellowship as part of the overall training. And we write a thesis, and this is to receive what we call your master's in surgery degree. So you become a fellow. I was a fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons, and then followed by that, I did my MCH, or master's of surgery. And it was a requirement then for the research that you'd be in an accredited institution. And Tufts University offered me that opportunity. And the project was a combination with MIT, Department of Chemical Engineering. Dr. Ed Merrill was the lead there, and they were developing a series of hydrogels, and this was the basis of my thesis. I was also a fellow from Pfizer, sponsored by Pfizer, and they at that time had a medical device division, and they were looking to evaluate the thrombogenicity of various gels from a point of view of a new vascular graft, particularly small caliber vascular graft for cardiac surgery bypass, and that was the basis of my thesis. And this was ultimately the work I did in the New England Medical Center, which led up to me receiving my qualification. I had the great fortune to meet some other great fellows there. One was Dr. Elliot Chaikoff, professor now in Boston. And he was very good to me in my time. He was undertaking his doctorate in MIT, so he kind of helped me through the whole research process. And so we had a lot of good times together, and got some very nice publications out of it. And that was really the academic side of what took me to New England Medical Center. In the New England Medical Center, there was a research lab run by Dr. Ray Connolly, and it had a baboon section and a canine section, whatever, and it offered all kinds of facilities to industry. So it was quite innovative. I mean, this is back in the late 80s, and they attracted in industry, and it was during this time that really I got the bug for innovation. I had an interest in engineering, but now to see medicine coming together with just first-class innovation, catheter-based procedures were only just taking off. And it was there that really I saw things that, of course, I would never see in Ireland. And this was really what got me into the swing of the entrepreneurial ship, thinking what I could do to contribute in this area.
So did you ever start your clinical practice, either in the U.S. or in Dublin, or did you just completely go into research and development?
During that time in which was over 2 years in Boston, after that, having had the great experiences of the research, I went back then into practice in Germany. So I had the good fortune to work under Professor Treudel in Cologne University, and he actually pioneered laparoscopic cholecystectomy in Germany, and I was the kind of the Irish visiting fellow for a couple of years there. During the time that I was there, and I had sought him out because I'd heard this was happening, this laparoscopic revolution was going to take off. It had just started in France, actually. And Professor Treudel brought up Professor Perissat from Bordeaux. And in Cologne then, we, as a team, led by Professor Troil, performed the first laparoscopic cholecystectomy in Germany. There had only been three done in France at that time. So I was at the cutting face of, here it was a, you know, a guy who had been a general and a vascular surgeon, used to making big incisions, and now this laparoscopic revolution was happening, and this again drove my innovation kind of bug further. And so I practiced there, and then went back to Ireland, and I was again vascular surgery with Professor Boucher Hayes, and then I got a call from the Pfizer connection through the New England Medical Center that they were looking for a medical director in Europe for, at that time, Pfizer. It was Lederle and Wyatt, these pharma companies, plus Davis and Geck and Sherwood and a few other companies were all kind of mixed in under the Pfizer umbrella. And they asked me, would I be interested to move to London to become the international medical director? And at that time, I was still practicing surgery, and I was practicing in the Central Middlesex Hospital in London. And I wasn't doing full time, but I was doing, you know, quite substantial amount of time. But this was with the company. They wanted me to keep on working as a surgeon in addition to being their international medical director for Europe, Middle East and Africa, and running their clinical trials and then interfacing all the R&D between Danbury in Connecticut and Europe. So that was kind of a dual role I had. So I didn't jump into being a startup person straight away. It was this transition from being a medical director. And that's really where I learned the ropes of how structured research was done under this big corporate machine, really. So that was the sort of the leap I had to make to convince my wife that I was going to now go part-time surgery, part-time R&D, let's say, in entrepreneurship.
So were you practicing at that point in London? Were you able to get a position, a clinical position in London?
Yes. Okay. I was an honorary lecturer in Central Middlesex Hospital in London. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. And I had a lot of connections there as well, who work with some of the guys there.
How, this is just an opinion at this point early in our conversation, but how do you feel about these physicians that divest part of their time to involve themselves with technology and development while still holding clinical positions that could be very demanding and very time consuming? Is it a disservice to the medical device technology development that we have these people that are potentially distracted? Or on the other hand, steel manning the other side of this argument, would it be that is essentially people like yourself that understand the daily needs and that are in the driving seat of vascular care, the people that should be leading these companies and should be developing these companies, even if that means taking a break away from their full-time positions?
Well, at that time, I was kind of in transition and very well supported by the hospital. They wanted somebody to cover their colleagues, you know, when they'd go on conferences or go on leave or whatever. So I was able to fill that gap. But I would think in general, so I was able to do that just because of the nature of the cross cover that was between the colleagues and my part was to do, and the continuity of care, of course, was there within the whole department with the other colleagues. But I do think, you know, there comes a point when you have to say, I can't do both. And, you know, and that's at that stage, because I was working with a US multinational, I was able to carve the time out. But then when I became an entrepreneur for myself, I had to stop practice per se and take the leap into the entrepreneurship and dedicate full time to that, because of all the pressures associated with startups. Basically, at the point when I was in the Central Middlesex, I had the cover and the luxury of working for a large multinational who allowed me to carve the time out as necessary to deal with patient care.
So how do you transition from working for a big company to then starting your own projects? How was that transition?
Yeah. That's a good question. So I learned the structures of how it all worked, you know, what's involved in an R&D project, from the idea, from the concept, to how you need to take it through all the various steps. And I felt I just wanted to do it for myself. At that stage now, I was approaching 40 years of age. I'd been in practice, quite a long time, and I had been learning the ropes as to how to start. I didn't just jump in. The company, American Home Products, American Cyanamid, they sponsored an MBA for me when I was transitioning in the surgery and in being their medical director. And between learning that financial structure of how a business works and learning how a corporate develops a project with very good quality and regulatory systems, I felt then I was equipped with the tools to jump out myself. And so I took some time to look at, you know, what area would I like to apply for with a new technology. And I realized that more and more holes were being made, you know, from a percutaneous point of view. And it was vascular surgeons who were ending up fixing a lot of these. So that was the area that I chose to combine my vascular skills together with the necessity in the clinical field of complications associated with this emerging percutaneous approach to big and small holes. Dr. Parodi was just starting off with the aneurysm grafts and so on. So the holes were getting bigger and bigger, and the problems were getting bigger and bigger. So that's kind of the area that I decided to jump into, and I felt pretty well equipped. My wife was probably would like to have seen a bit more kind of stability behind it, because obviously the risk when you leave a good job and there is a risk associated with that. We moved back to Ireland. I was back and forth on the plane when working for the multinational, and I met my co-founder, Christy Cummins, who's also sadly no longer with us, had a subarachnoid hemorrhage a few years ago. But we were working together for many years. He was the head of R&D and I was the medical guy. So we came back to Ireland, or I did, moved back after 8 years in London. And we got a premises together and assembled some angel investors and put in some of our own money. And we started off our first venture. And so that was the big leap from the golden handcuffs of corporations to the ups and downs of being an entrepreneur.
I feel that we have a lot of conversations with entrepreneurs in this cast, and there's this repetitive notion or this repetitive message that everybody that's found success has been through some pretty dark days, be that maybe emotionally, financially, family. There's these, but like everything, right? I mean, you do that also in your career, when you're doing residency, when you're doing training. But I find that for physicians, and you said it perfectly, right? My wife probably would have wished that I stayed in a more stable scenario, because that's in many ways, and I'm tying in some of the conversations we've had with James Sexton, right? Our good friend who's a divorce lawyer. He said the reason why you are very attractive to people in general is because you bring stability to the table. And I'm kind of talking, I guess, also in a personal way, that we were having a conversation the other day with another couple about our business ventures. And we're talking about all these headaches financially that we're doing because of our new business and these things. And I remember our wives looking at each other and they said, well, we thought we married doctors. And here we are trying to figure out how to get our banks to reapprove a loan or to write this loan. And what are we going to do to this? But is there anything that worked for you, Jim, that you could say, you know, looking back, was it that you feel you picked the right partner that gave you that bandwidth? Was it that you had ways in which you can bring her down or bring both of yourselves up, I guess? Share a little bit more on that human aspect of how you would maneuver these dark days between the transition, because it's always great to speak. You know, it's always easy to be the Monday morning quarterback, but at the time, I'm sure there was a lot of emotional strain.
Yeah, well, you're hitting a nerve there, Miguel, because the first venture actually failed. I put a lot into it. It was a company called Nova Science, It failed, but we got an exit out of it, but I'll explain to you. So basically, because of the vascular surgery and general surgery, the first approach we took to closure was a stapling device. And so we had this, myself and Christy worked this expandable staple that could go down small and open up. And you know, we realized, you know, pretty early, well, about 2 years into the project, we weren't getting it right. This was not the right way to close a hole. I mean, in theory, it's a great way if you could staple it, but you need to be able to see it. But what we did have a foot in the device at the front end, which stabilized as you pulled back from the lumen of the artery, and then you put the staple down. We could not get our staple to work. And at the same time, the folks who were coming out with the StarClose device, they had a crown of thorns kind of that went down, but they didn't have the stabilizing foot. So Abbott had acquired or was acquired or had acquired a StarClose, and then they approached us for the IP for the foot. So that was the exit we got, but we didn't get the product, if you know what I mean. It didn't go well in our initial pilot studies. So we were kind of, I suppose, fortunate in a way that the Abbott were able to combine the foot of our technology, of our IP, with the crown of the StarClose device. And so that gave us a bit of money to, you know, go again. But to your question, you see, they were sweaty days, particularly when I'm going home to my wife and say, well, actually, we're bailing out of this project. Yeah. And to be able to call a project to stop it is a very tough decision. You know, we had a small, very good team. And, you know, it was for them as well. They're going home to their families saying, you know, this venture did not work. Some of those guys, okay, we didn't necessarily entice them away from multinationals, but they did want to start in a startup and in an entrepreneurial environment. So they took a risk as well and backed me and Christy by joining us. But we were fortunate in ways that we got some monies, which allowed us to buy our own R&D facility in Dublin and equip it out. But we weren't sure what we were going to do. We were just thinking, what's our next venture? And that's when we kind of came up with the concept of the current platform technology, which the KELT vascular closure device is based. But we had a hiatus between the failure, or the unloading of the IP versus starting into the KELT project itself. So, it's being a nice stable doctor with a good income, or in my case as well, being in a multinational with good share options is a nice position to be. So it is very rocky to jump out. And but I was 40 years of age, and you just say you've got certain milestones in your life, certain things you want to try and achieve. And I'd done a lot of surgery, and I wanted to really try this. And my wife was very supportive, but nevertheless, it's stressful, or can be, if it's not going the way you would hope it would go. So
I feel some of the sleepless nights. Sorry, Lucas. Some of the sleepless nights are not necessarily what's going to happen at home, because I feel that somehow you've probably chosen somebody that you know can take it, right? I feel that whoever you have decided, even though you may have painted a different picture at the beginning, you know that at the core, if you've chosen right, is somebody that's going to be accepting of this craziness, right? I mean, that's part of the attraction, is this big dreams, big plans kind of man, this person or woman, right, to that point. But so I don't worry about myself or my home or my wife's. Of course, you know, it's self-survival. You want to worry about the wife. But the sleepless nights come with the team, because it's the people that you bring in, that you convince to jump on this, that they're potentially in stable jobs, but you attract them to, and now all of a sudden you are not only responsible for your own house, but you're responsible for 10 or 12 other households. And what does that mean for them and for the livelihood of their families? That's where the tricky part on this, you don't sometimes talk about these dark nights. So it's interesting to see another.
Yeah, the more responsibilities you take on, the more risk you take on. So, or the more risk, the more responsibility. Yeah. So how did the idea of the new closure device come up? Did you immediately come up with it? Was it an aha moment where you're like, oh, okay, this is what I should have done instead of the staples?
Yeah. Well, my brother, he was a successful kind of guy, and he had a house down in France. And after the first endeavor, he invited me down with my wife, and we were just down for a week. It was really unfinished business. It felt that, you know, this everything was booming in the percutaneous world, you know, and good closure devices still weren't out there. Even, you know, even like Startos is a good device, but you know, it has like everything has its shortcomings. So we decided, or I decided to, you know, try and take a second shot at it, really. And when I was down on holidays, and then Christy, he was off, you know, with his family, and we were just taking it just a little bit of time out. I was in a hardware store, and came, you know, because I was like looking at, you know, what other things are doing there, and could they be applied in some way. So I bought these, we call them Hilti bolts. I'm not sure what you call them, but the bolts that you turn a screw, and they kind of expand, and you can put them into walls to hang a picture off or whatever. So the portion that goes in behind the plasterboard in the wall expands and gives you a stable structure that won't pull out. So I bought a few bags of these things and started putting them together, and kind of realized that, you know, there was a way potentially to independently open these bolts with wings independent of each other. But of course, they're quite proud, and they wouldn't necessarily go down a sheet, you know, and keep and go into a vessel in a smooth manner. So just started thinking about it, and realized that maybe a cylinder with a particular pattern could, by a twisting motion, could open a wing off a flat surface. So a cylinder which in laser cut basically could do that. And just got some paper when I was on holidays, actually, and drew out some patterns, and then cut out the patterns, or you know, with a kind of scalpel blade. And then realized by rotating the paper roll that this pattern would open up into a wing. And then by doing a counterclockwise motion, you could open a second wing independently. So that was the basis of the Kelt device, which is basically a rivet in your Levi jeans. It's got two wings, one inside, one outside. And but how do you open these wings independent of each other? And that was the IP. So I called Christy when he was on holidays and I was in France, and he said, "I don't know what you're talking about. So we'll talk when you get back, and you can bring your bits of paper." So he was a brilliant designer or whatever. So I showed him what I had, and then he, you know, drew it up properly and again on paper, and big sheets of paper. And then we decided we still hadn't formed the company yet, so we decided that we'd send it out, the drawings out to Germany. Lasers were very unusual at that point, you know. There was big fights among cardiac companies who were making stents. There were just a shortage of lasers, but there was a company in Germany who could make this pattern. It was very expensive, and they did cut it, but it didn't quite work properly. And every time we wanted to go back, it was another iteration, another expense, whatever. But there's a lot of heavy industry and medical device. The big med techs are in Ireland, and Abbott was actually getting in a whole new set of lasers with fiber optics, and they were divesting of a CO2 laser they had. So that we got it quite cheap off them, and it was really great. And we got somebody to help us program it up. And so now we had our own laser. Now we were able to make iterations on the fly, so to say, that we didn't have to send everything to Germany. And then we realized that we could make a go of this. And that was the genesis of the thought process with the Kelt. We started it off actually with out of magnesium. We got ingots of magnesium, and we got them drawn again by another company, another metals company. But unfortunately, magnesium, when you twist it, it's a very brittle material, and it was breaking. And you know, we felt it would. We originally called the product Trizolve, because it was going to be three petals on each wing, and that was the name of the. But it was breaking, and you know, we thought it would embolize. And even though it does resorb, but it obviously wouldn't resorb quick enough to you know, to avoid ischemia of distal vessels. So we had to abandon that. Again, it was a hard decision, because that was going to be an absorbable metal implant. It would have been the first, and it was. Wow. But so we switched over to a very thin 316 LVM stainless steel, and which at that time stents were being made of stainless steel and was MRI compatible. And that's turned out to be just a wonderful material. It flattens very easy. It takes up a very low profile, and it endothelializes really well. So it's out of the vascular system very quickly, and it's visible under X-ray. So you can do a restick, whatever. So it had all these characteristics that allowed us to progress with the first Celts, and we set up the company. Now we pulled back a lot of the people who were working for us before, like our regulatory person has been with us for 20 years, and our office administrator again the same time, and our, you know, and Christy and I have been together for years. So we had an old team, was kind of to reassemble the band and go again, and with a lot more kind of confidence that we would deliver this time. So that was the genesis of the Celt.
So Christy, you keep mentioning Christy. What's Christy's role? What's his background?
Yeah, so Christy Cummins, he was the head of R&D of Sherwood Medical, and I was an international medical director. And I would go to St. Louis, Missouri, and I'd come out of London, and he'd come out of Dublin, and we'd meet over there. So we're both Irish guys, but we didn't know each other apart from through the company. So he was a designer and R&D guy. So he was the engineering, kind of the real engineering behind putting together our team, and I was the medical side of it, and, you know, knew the clinical problem. So we assembled the team together and reassembled it together. And actually, we spun out another company as well, a women's health company, and that's just about to start FDA trials in the near future, using exactly the same platform. So this Celt plug, we use it to plug fallopian tubes for ambulatory hysteroscopic sterilization. So it would go down through a hysteroscope, and we'd open the wings in the fallopian tube. So this was now a way for women not to need to have a tubal ligation via laparoscopy. So it was getting away totally from laparoscopy, all run through the uterus under vision. And so we set up a separate company in that regard. And with the blessing of the boards, we used a lot of the same facilities and same people. So that was able, we were able to kind of, because money is very hard to raise, or was and is, and we were able to kind of get really good value by assigning people to both projects and, you know, having the costs and that kind of thing. So that was a kind of a next but parallel project that we had with the Celt device.
So when did you kind of figure out that it really works really well? Because I had the introduction, I've been using the Celt since I was in San Antonio more than 4 years ago. Some of the local private guys were using it, and they were sending me patients, and I would see these like metal plugs, and yeah, I would cut down on them, and I was like, okay, this doesn't seem like it's interfering at all. The first time you see it, you're like, what is this? Because it's very different. But then you know, they would send them to me for hybrid surgeries or open surgeries and stuff like that. I would cut down and couldn't really find the thing. And then I was curious and started using it. And I was like, anything that makes my life simple, I immediately gravitate to. So this thing like made my life simple and reliable. You know, I found myself not worrying after using it a while, not worrying about hematomas or post-op bleeding and stuff like that. And I was like, oh man, this thing kind of really works. Then I decided, okay, this is what I'm going to use. When did you kind of figure out, oh, like this really works? Like I hit the nail on the head. This is a great design. Was there an aha moment for you?
Yeah, and it was very early on. So once we optimized the size and the shape, and we made three sizes, one for a 5, one for a 6, one for 7 French. So we're going after the small bore market, and it would go down the existing sheet. But we had to obviously trial it. So we had trialed it in animals, which is fine, you know, open aortas. But the first percutaneous cases, we did them actually in Germany, and with interventional cardiologists. And we knew by their reaction, they were getting immediate hemostasis, and they were bending the patient's leg, and they were sitting them up. And we were nervous because they were normally keeping patients in bed for 4 hours, you know, at that point. But they were really, because they probably just felt that we can bail ourselves out or whatever, or it's manual pressure if there's a problem. So that was the moment. And this was for a CE mark trial. And then we came back to Dublin. And then we got a second center in Dublin who would be another limb of the trial, let's say. And those guys did early ambulation of the patients. And that was really what was was quite eye-opening for us. And so we got our CE mark, and we always intended it was to, you know, to go to the US with this device. And Dr. Chu Wong in New York Presbyterian Hospital, he was really a great PI for us for the FDA trial. It was a PMA. And he really helped us through the trial. We didn't have a lot of money. Again, money was very tight. We weren't VC backed. It was hard. We were mainly high net worth individuals, and we really had to make the money stretch. The FDA initially suggested it was a 400 patient study, and that would be for 200 diagnostics or roughly, and the same for PCIs with full anticoagulation. So we asked, well, if we skip the diagnostic, how about that? We just go straight for the PCIs, because we've seen the results with the, we knew we were confident for the CE mark patients. And they said, well, that's up to you. But if you bomb any part of this, you will not have a diagnostic indication either. So they said eventually then, yeah, okay, it's a 207 patient study. So we have the study, only went for high risk PCIs, fully anticoagulated, and went sailed through it with Dr. Chu Wong as the PI. And so all of that helped us now to really raise a bit more money to commercialize in the United States. And it was all during this time that we started doing some small sales in Europe, but in Germany, and our great colleague and sales vice president, David Gunter, in the US, he had seen the device being used actually in closed brachial arteries off label for AV fistula formation. And he had contacted us, and he stayed in touch with us right up till we finished the trial with Chu Wong and got the PMA approval. And now David is our wonderful US sales manager, who's really grown our business very substantially.
I have a question. As we have a lot of followers that are entrepreneurs themselves, or that are tickled by the entrepreneur journey, if you had to go, not going back in time, but if you had to advise them to make best friends with one of the next three people, tell me who you think would be the right person to pair up early on. Should they pair up with a lawyer? Should they pair up with an engineer? Or should they pair up with a venture capitalist? Which of those three people in the journey of an entrepreneur should they seek to somehow network themselves into and maybe create a very tight relationship early in their medical career to try to find success?
Yeah. Well, firstly, they really need to choose their idea before they think of pairing up with anybody. They need to really try and take advantage of the fact that you're in a residency, or you're a fellow, or you're an attending. You know, you don't want to rush this. I mean, I might maybe have rushed it a little bit, but I had the safety net of having the intermediate step of the multinational. Whereas, you know, what you're asking me is somebody who might think of if they're going to step out. But the person they really, once they choose their area, the person they really, it's the engineer. Like, they're the medic. They need somebody to execute this. The rest of it comes. The lawyer is the patent lawyer. Is the good guy. Yeah. that all falls in together, and the investor will come if it's the right mousetrap. So it's choose the people that you want to be really working with closely to bring this idea to fruition. But number one, choose the idea right, because you can go down a lot of rabbit holes, and you know, it can cause you to have to back out and go down a different road and pivot, so to say.
So one of the things that you talk a lot with these idea developing groups, and I've been part of a lot of these melting pots, if you may, of ideas and scientists. And most of these developing entities, the first thing they want to ask you is, you know, who's your target? You know, what is the business? Are you competing against people that already have it? And is there a true need for this? Is there a market need for this? And one of those questions that becomes very important when we're looking at the funding exercise, and not that I'm necessarily a capital allocator, but I am an advisor to multiple capital allocating entities. And one of the inevitable questions that always comes to the table is, do you have reimbursement codes? And that I can see is an unclear to me why, because we all use closure devices. All go home feeling better. It's better patient care, early ambulation, and the list of reasons why is, you know, endless, yet there's no reimbursement. And I feel that a lot of capital allocators would be immediately turned off by venturing into a space that potentially has already some settled competitors with a market share that's pretty kind of knit tight already. And so it's an open question about your funding when there are these clear, evident issues that some people would have in even looking at this project, which, again, obviously in hindsight, successful to this point and probably has an incredibly successful path forward. But how do you manage that? And how was that funding time in the setting of those questions that are typical at the beginning?
Yeah, so I think it's the sizzle in the sausage for this product is the early ambulation and discharge. That was the initial to get us, you know, interest from venture capital or from high net worths, and we have a private equity investor in it as well. And then it was the likes of David who really helped us, David Gunter, our salesperson, who really identified that a lot of his customers were just applying for an FDA approval, but they're using our 7 French device off-label to close 9 French holes in stroke cases, and, you know, getting the early ambulation and discharge with hypertension because they keep these patients hypertensive. So now that's a real niche as well. So now suddenly you're getting into a bigger hole space. And we're bringing also which is a second string to our bow. We've developed a large bore closure device. We'll be closing up to 20 French. We're going to start our IDE trials at the end of the summer. We just completed our GLP animal studies. And we put a lot of extra features. And because bleeding is with the large bore holes, as you know, is a major issue. We believe we've got an answer with it because we put in a lot of safety features, and this again attracts the investors, attracts our key opinion leaders to advise our investors that this is a good thing to have. Like, we have this device on a wire, we've got a blood signal in it, we're able to see it under ultrasound, and we can reverse it and take it out over the wire if for any reason that you're not comfortable. You can shoot an angiogram through the device as well. So all of these things allow us now to have really complete the offering of closures. I know what you mean, that there's a lot of closures around, but ours is performing so well with this early ambulation and discharge, and we've recently had some studies done to show that the PACU cost savings of $2,000 a patient. So even though there's no reimbursement per se, and they're part of a DRG, we want them to reach for our closure, because the closure is going to continue. Now, you know, a lot of it in cardiology is migrating to the wrist, but with the renal denervation being reintroduced, this can change, and our device is giving you quicker discharge even than a wristband, because you have to keep the patient around if you go radial and watch and take off the band, whereas our patients are going out the door in 40 minutes in our OBL centers. So really, I don't know if there's that answered, Miguel, but we're trying to differentiate ourselves to attract the investment to your question, and you know, to break the apathy around closure devices. And we're only scratching the surface, because you know, Dave has got a very small team. He has been very successful, and so we want to go deep now and get it out there more and more. And we think it'll bring a lot of people around to seeing the advantages that this technology is offering.
Jim, well, I can tell you one thing on my end. I transitioned a year ago now or more into the outpatient setting, and that's where everything's going, right? I think it's inevitable to not foresee that we are going to have more and more of these outpatient downgraded cardiovascular offerings, to your point, right? A lot more procedures to a lot more people, a lot more holes to close. And despite the fact that you may not necessarily have a CPT code for reimbursement, fact of the matter is, the number one reason why OBLs are expensive are, number one, the materials, and number two, staff. And what does that mean? Well, it means that if I need to stay, you know, if I need to keep nurses over to just care for a groin for 4 hours or 6 hours or whatever that is, it is just absolutely against the model of efficiency in care. And so I think that the case for a financial explanation is clear when it comes to efficiency. It would be beautiful, because I'm sure that your adoption would go off the roof, that there would be CPT codes that then would financially compensate an OBL for having this, because it would potentially be safer procedures. But I think the efficiency for the OBL side is I get my patients out, I ambulate these patients faster. And I do believe that the inflammatory reaction in comparison to some of the other competitors in the market is way less. I do ultrasound-guided closure, ultrasound-guided access, and ultrasound-guided closure on every one of my patients. I've been doing it. I mean,
you showed me how
back
to
in the
it,
days, I taught it to you, and I hope that you've taught it to other people. But one of the things that's very interesting when you access these groins, because people say, well, those are absorbable, for example, an angioseal, right? Well, when I have to reintroduce a needle into an angioseal,
Cut down
is a complete nightmare. But even reintroduce a needle in the inflammatory tissue in and around
the problem is when you want to introduce the sheath.
It's almost like you did a bypass or an endarterectomy. Yeah. I mean, it's not that much, but it's like along the lines
it can mess up the sheath pretty easily.
But I didn't feel that when I've had to poke through previous celts. Is that you're also understand, like when you go through, you say you use it a lot more than I do.
Yeah.
When you go through, do you feel that there's a lot of tissue that you're battling trying to get your needle through?
No. And you know, the issue that I find most with these inflammatory reactions is when you have to put in either the micro sheath, if you have one of those really flimsy micro sheaths that kind of suck, or the regular sheath. It can mess up the contour of it, and then it can injure your artery when you're going in. So I haven't found that. And you know, back in the day when I was getting sent these patients and I wasn't using it, you know, there would be, you know, two celts in there. At the beginning, as I said, I was worried. I was like, okay, like, do I need to like aim a different way, or like how do I do my ultrasound guidance so I avoid it? But it never has become an issue.
What's the explanation, Jim? Why is this seem to be a less, even though there's something left behind?
Because
there's the hesitation of a lot of doctors. I don't like leaving anything behind.
Yeah.
But then it seems to me like there's a much less inflammatory reaction to this than to some of the other devices. Could you just expand on your understanding of the histological implications?
Yeah. So the material is, as I mentioned, 316 LVM stainless steel, which is the highest grade of biocompatible steel and MRI compatible also. So we, unlike, Angioseal, of course, is the number one. And even the suturing devices are sutures, and sutures, depending on the polymer, can set up an inflammatory process. And the way the Angioseal works, or the collagen-based plugs, is they set up an inflammatory reaction, and along with inflammation is healing, and along with that then is fibrosis. So we're a very inert material, the celt is, and it's like I'm sure you've taken out lots of pacemakers. They're just encased in a fine film of fibrous tissue. That's all. It doesn't excite an inflammatory process in itself, because we're not breaking down anything. So all it is putting a film over the implant for endothelialization rapidly inside, and on the outside on the adventitia. So there is no gross inflammation process going on, which, you know, will result in a woody groin and difficulty in restick or whatever. And of course you can see the thing if you want to restick anyway, or a needle will bounce off it and you can go above or below or to the right or the left. So inflammation is really not a key concern with the healing of this implant in situ.
And I've seen a couple of pictures of it actually kind of leaving the wall of the blood vessel and being like not on the inside, on the outside completely. Have you seen those images? Can you explain that? I
We don't fully know what that you see that sometimes, but it's in late, obviously late, you know, months after the implantation, or if the patient's coming back for a redo procedure. So we don't know at the time. So the gap between the wings is 1.5 millimeters. And as you know, the distance between the thickness can be 1 to 3 millimeters, or, you know, depending on what you're, you know, what you work at the sclerosis you're dealing with. So sometimes we wonder, when you pull up, does part of the inside wing, the distal wing, you know, get caught in the puncture itself? And now the body is kind of working its way with peristalsis of the pulsations of, and just popping it gently out over time, but with healing as it goes behind it. So, because you never see any pseudoaneurysms, or, you know, extremely rarely. I mean, we never get called to say we've got a stenosis of the artery, or we've got a pseudoaneurysm or whatever. So we think that's happening a little bit with the pulsations, particularly for the smaller ones, the 5 French ones, where the wings are tiny, and it's nature's way of just kind of moving it out of the field. So it's totally extravascular, you know, at that point. And so it's a good thing.
So right now there's 5, 6, and 7 French, correct?
Yeah, but I've used the 7 and a 9, and it works fine.
9 French. This is obviously outside of the IFU.
It's outside the IFU.
Okay, the IFU is 1 to 1, right? 5 for a 5, 6 for a 6, 7 for a 7. Yeah. And you say that you're potentially going to go into how big of a size this year in the next few years?
Yeah, we're going to go up to 20 French. So we've got two devices coming, a 14 French for 14 and 16, and an 18 French for 18 and 20. And we're being sponsored actually by a large US multinational. They think that they really like what they've seen, and they think it's going to drive adoption of their very expensive implants, which I won't mention the company in a minute, but so that's a great thing that they kind of have endorsed us, and they're just giving us a very low interest loan rather than taking any equity. They just want the product out there. So that's been a really good thing for us. And we have another company actually who's looking at the large bore technology. And because it's on a wire, it needs to be plugged. So it's a kit when it comes with on a wire. You put out when everything is set, you can shoot an angio through the device, and you can plug it then once you remove the wire. But there's another company who are looking at taking the rivet, so the large bore, and using it to join Dacron grafts to blood vessels. So an automated anastomosis coupler, let's say.
Wow.
And they want to use it as a conduit for getting something into the body. But equally, you could do an axfem bypass, for example, do the two ends using this device, if we take it further. So they're exploring that project with us. So it's exactly the same technology, but except it's got a much bigger lumen to obviously allow the blood into the graft.
Yeah, when I was using it here, I'm gonna throw you $1 million bone there, Jim. I was thinking that it would be so cool that you could make an intraoperative gun that has multiple loads of it. So if you can load, give me 10 Celts on an automatic gun that I could use intraoperatively. And I could see myself using that. A lot of times we're doing an anastomosis on a really bad vessel, and you start using pledgets, and you start trying to put this little stitch. And then the moment you put that one, the next one falls off and you rip a little bit. And it would be so cool that if you know there's a little tiny hole, all you do is grab the gun, push it through the hole, press the first click, the star will open on the inside, you pull back a little bit and you put the second one, and it just smashes whatever small hole you're doing. So imagine that you could just do it on the go instead of clips, right? Instead of vascular clips for anastomosis or holes or things that, or maybe, you know, you're in a very deep cavity and you can't get there. Or think about robotic. I mean, we're moving now into vascular robotic surgery. You know, sometimes it's not easy to put a stitch in a weird place, even though the robot's really facile. But again, if the vessel isn't great, think that this is a way of just creating a hole without disrupting the vessel.
If it could grab the adventitia part.
I don't know, because I believe that the value of this is exactly that you're not using the outside.
Yeah.
It creates its own plate to where it just smashes like a burger. It's a yo-yo.
No, I understand, but you could injure something I think it'd be less difficult to injure something if it just grab seven to show like that.
Jim, we want to be part of your next endeavor here. Yeah, with a robotic kilt.
Yeah. All right, Jim. Well, we're coming to an end. We want to be mindful of your time. We really appreciate you taking time out of your weekend to spend some time with us and explain this journey. Just wanted to see if there's anything else that you wanted to add.
No, I just want to say that the message out there to anybody who choose your idea carefully and don't jeopardize your family for the idea. Yeah. And if it's a good technology, the rest will follow. Choose your team, the rest will follow. And I really appreciate Lucas and Miguel the opportunity to talk to you guys. Very interesting from my point of view. The U.S. has opened my world. Like I'm an Irish guy, small. Got the break as a young guy, and the U.S. is where it's at. And I spent a lot of time looking at structural heart meetings and looking at all kinds of meetings. And I just come away every time learning something. Every day is a learning journey for me. And this has been a great interaction too. And I've learned a lot. And look forward to meeting you in person for a beer sometime. So.
Yeah, oh, that would be great.
A Guinness.
Yeah.
No, thank you very much, man.
We won't give any brand names.
We certainly appreciate and applaud your career, your ideas. I'm sure there's going to be a ton more to come, and we look forward to, to supporting you in your success. So thank you very much for carving time to being here. For those of you out there that have never used it or have never had any, go ahead and, I'd say Google some information, get in touch with this team. There is an American branch.
Yeah, we'll put a link.
And there's going to be links on the bottom because I think it's worth you testing it out, putting it in your hands, using it a few times. You will probably be genuinely impressed with the possibilities that you'll get. So anyway, Jim, thank you very much for your time.
Appreciate it very much, guys. Have a great evening or afternoon for you guys. Evening for me. I'm off to watch the rugby, England, Ireland. Come on, Ireland.
Yeah. All right.
Fantastic. We'll be rooting for Ireland.
Bye-bye.
Thanks very much, guys. Have a nice evening. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.